Normally we do two options. We do two questions that came up over the past week, and then we give a choice of which one to ask about. But last week we did three options, so this week there's only one option.
No.
So that's the way we're going to do it. So what we're going to discuss is a fascinating back and forth. One second, let me just mute everybody. I can't figure out how right now. They changed the whole... Oh, no, there we go. You know. Okay. So, yeah. So, anyway, so... So last week we did we did three options. So this week I think what we're going to do is we'll do one option. And there's a shaila that's been coming up a lot, although it may not be nogea to us. I think it's to many of us. I think it's a fascinating shaila. I got the shaila from a guy who owns an apartment in Israel. The apartment that he owns is an investment apartment, meaning he figures, the way he describes it, is that he bought an apartment in Ramat Eshkol. Right now, he's able to rent it out to people all the time. And when Mashiach comes, my gosh, real estate is going to skyrocket over there. So he figures it's a fantastic, fantastic investment. Who are the people that are living in Ramat Eshkol? It's used to be a Chiloni neighborhood. Now it's a young Haredi American neighborhood. It's a bunch of people who are spending Shana Rishona learning in the Mir or wherever for the first year or two of their marriage before they come back to America. So he signs the people who rent the apartment signed a 1-year lease that started, let's say, August 1st and ends July 31st. And then Corona happened. So right after Purim, they realized that if they don't get out of the country right then, they're not going to be able to spend Pesach with their parents. So they moved up all their flights. They went home and they went back to America. And now they're in America and they can't get back to Israel because the borders are closed. They're not able to get to fly back to Israel. So the young people that are renting the apartment said, we're not going to pay rent on an apartment that we're not using. We didn't use it for half of March and for all of April and for all of May. And, we're not going to pay, and who knows, probably for all of June also. So we're not going to pay rent on the apartment for that time. And this fellow said, that's not fair. You signed a lease. The lease is for a full year. So you have to pay rent on the apartment. So the shaila is, who's right? Now, in general, whenever we deal with the Dine Mamonis issue, it's always a little more complicated than other areas of halacha, because there are so many factors, and whatever halacha you're going to open up to in Shulchan Aruch, what you're dealing with is never exactly what you're opening up to in Shulchan Aruch. There's never like an exact match. In fact, Rav Asher Weiss wrote a long tshuva about this topic. He got so much feedback/pushback on that tshuva that he had to issue another tshuva that was just a one-page tshuva that said, you're never going to find an exact match for anything, and you need seichel ayashar. And this has to be paskined with sensitivity and with seichel. Ad kan, I'm not discussing it any further. Meaning, if you were to respond, maybe the fact that you need to quarantine in a hotel is more like this case in Shulchan Aruch. There is no case in Shulchan Aruch of coronavirus and young Americans going home and their parents are paying the rent. And that, you don't have anything like that. The whole situation is so different from anything that you're ever going to have in Shulchan Aruch. But as a basic guide to figure out the principles, we can certainly look at certain sugyos. So what I'd like to do is to go through Rav Asher Weiss's tshuva, not inside, but to summarize or really just go through every detail of what Rav Asher Weiss says in his tshuva. We'll see if we're able to do it in the half hour allotted. And along the way, one of the people that gave feedback/pushback was my brother, Shlita, the Rosh Kollel in Palo Alto, California. And he sent a three-page response of a number of points. I would like to incorporate a number of my brother's points along the way as well. So Rav Asher Weiss starts by saying, before we get into the principle that you hear most often quoted in this context, which is a principle called Makas Medina, that when something happens that strikes the entire country, then all bets are off. The rules are going to change. Before we figure out about changing the rules, we have to first figure out what the rules are, right? What happens if there is an agreement in place and then an ones happens, something that's beyond anybody's control? Not necessarily a Makas Medina, but just something that's beyond anybody's control. So what do we do in such cases? So there is a Ramah in Simon Shin Lamed Daled in Choshen Mishpat, Si'if Aleph, where the Ramah discusses if a socher dies within the period of a schirus, right? Let's say you have a person who rents an apartment. He's the tenant in the apartment. He signs a 2-year lease and he dies after a year and a half. So is he obligated to pay for that last half a year? Does it have to come out of his estate that last half a year? There's no one living in the apartment right now. He doesn't need to be there. He's dead. So what happens? So the Ramah writes, Misha sachar bayis ladur bo, umeis betoch zman haschirus, if he dies within the zman of the schirus, ein sarach l'shalim lo rak ma'ash adar bo, l'balabayis, d'balabayis, avikapol, v'avulei l'hasnos. The balabayis is like a poel, and they should have made a tanai, and they didn't make a tanai, and therefore he's not going to have to pay anything. However, the Rama says, mihu yesh cholkin. But some disagree. So what's the answer? Does he have to pay or does he not have to pay? If something happens out of his control, he dies in the middle of the schiras and they get... Does he... The answer? Machlokas. Some say yes, some say no. So what do you do when you have a machlokas in Dine Mamanis? So there is a principle of Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Haraya. So, you know, there are two different types of people. There are some people that will only pay at the very, very last minute when they absolutely must pay. You know, when the electric bill finally comes and says, we are shutting off your electricity, that's when they pay their electric bill. And then there are some people that as soon as they get the bill, or sometimes even before, if it's posted online, I don't like owing anybody any money. And they right away pay up front for as much as they possibly can. I'm more in the second category. I don't like owing anybody any money. For years, I didn't have a credit card. I still don't. I don't have a credit because the whole principle of a credit card is that you owe somebody money, and I just don't like debt. I don't like that whole principle, the whole concept, but everyone tells me I'm an idiot because you get all sorts of free stuff when you have credit card points, and if you pay tuitions on credit card, you could, travel the world when traveling used to be a thing. So now my wife has a credit card, and, but I still don't. I still don't like it. So there are the different types of people. So you have a person who prepays the rent for the entire year. So says the Ramah, he loses. He prepaid for the whole thing. Amotzi mechavero, la varaya. You want to get that money back from the landlord. Since it's a machlokas, whether he owes it, he gets to keep it. The Ramah writes, im kibel aschar kulo, ein sarich lahachzer klum, kenirali. The Shach agrees with the Ramah lahalacha. He disagrees with the Svara of how the Ramah got there, but the Shach agrees with the Ramah lahalacha. My brother just pointed out that there's another Ramah that seems to say otherwise in Simon Shin Yud Beis, when a city burned down and it was a Makas Medina, that he gets his money back even if he prepaid. So the Ramah holds that one is that the difference between the two cases is obvious, that when the onus is in the socher, like when the socher himself dies, then the prepayment is kept by the maskir. But when the onus is in the bias, like the city burnt down, then the prepayment has to be returned. So that's the Ramah. But the Nesivus understands differently. And he says that only when hisne kein behedya, only when you made an explicit tanai, only then you don't have to return the money. But if you didn't make an explicit tanai, you would have to return the money. But anyway, that is the Ramah. So the question is this called an onus, right? Do we consider the coronavirus happening an onus? On the one hand, of course it's an onus. Who in the world could have predicted it? So, yeah, but that doesn't make it an onus for them not to be living in their apartment. If anything, the virus would, and the rules that followed, make it that they're onus to dafka be in their apartments. So would it be called an onus? So really the way to look at it is not, is the coronavirus happening an onus? Obviously we don't control that. Is their leaving the apartment an onus? Is their not living in that apartment something that's within their control or something that's not within their control? So what do you say? Well, when they left, they could have stayed. So it was within their control not to leave. They decided to move up their flight. The young couple decided to move up their flight. 21-year-old newly minted Kala was not interested in, making Pesach 7 months pregnant or whatever. She was not interested in doing that. So they moved up their flights and they got out of there. But that was their choice to get out of there. On the other hand, once they got out of there, they weren't allowed back in. And that wasn't within their control. The government said, no, they're not allowed back in. So Rav Asher Weiss says that even if it says explicitly that the socher is not permitted to back out from the schirus, even in a situation of ones, a makas medina is going to be different. So we're going to have to get into the geder of a makas medina, because a makas medina is so out of left field, no one ever could have expected that. And he says, even it says in the lease agreement a lot of times, you know, an act of God or something like that, then the socher can back out and not pay, even if it's not spelled out explicitly. That's what we assume. That is, it says in the lease agreement that if there's an act of God, then the socher can back out. So we assume that with an act of God, even if it doesn't say it, he's allowed to back out, because he never would have imagined that he wouldn't be able to use the property. And that should mean that the socher should not need to pay. So what really remains is two questions. Number one, is this considered a makas medina, which is going to change the picture? Or is it just a regular ones? And number two, is the tenant authorized to be mevatel the agreement, in which case they got to get out of there, including get all their stuff out of the apartment? Or is the tenant even authorized to say, I'm not paying you as much, meaning I'm not picking up all my clothing. I have no way to get in there and get my clothing out of my towels and my sheets and my furniture and everything. I can't get in there. I understand you're housing it in your home, but I can't get in there. So can the tenant say, I don't want to be mevatel l'shchiras because I don't want you to throw all my stuff out in the street, but I don't want to pay as much? Is that something that he's authorized to say? So let's take one question at a time. Makas Medina. What is the idea of Makas Medina? There are two sugyas in Maseches Bava Metzia about Makas Medina. On Daf Kuf Gimel and Beis, the Mishnah says, HaMekabel Sada Mechavero, V'hi Beis HaShlachin, O Beis HaIlan, Yavash HaMayan, V'niktsas HaIlan, Menakalo Min Chakoro. That if you rent a field, and it's watered by having a spring of water right next to that field, and then, out of nowhere, the spring dries up, and there's no way to water the field, so the river dried up, it's a Makas Medina, and the farmer can decide that he's not going to pay because it's a Makas Medina, something he never would have imagined, that he wouldn't have the ability to work that field. The Mishnah on Daf Kuf Hei Amud Beis, HaMakabul Sada Mechaver Vach L'Chagav O Nishtefa, it gets eaten up by grasshoppers or something like that. Im Makas Medini Hi Menakalo Min Chakoro. If that problem didn't only happen to his field, it happened to all the fields, then he doesn't have to pay his payment. But if it's not a makas medina, it just happened to his field, then that's what we call an ones. And an ones, he may still have to pay. So it's explicit in the Mishnah that if it's a makas medina, you can subtract from the payment. And the Gemara says, Hechi dami makas medina. What does it mean that there's a makas medina? I'm reviewed the kagon di ishtuf ruba debaga. It means most of that neighborhood got ruined. That it's all the surrounding fields. If all the surrounding fields, not just his field, got ruined, then that's a makas medina. So how do we pass? So la halacha, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Chirus, and Shulchan Aruch pass in Siman Shin Chav Beis, like Rabbi Yehuda, that if the majority of that neighborhood, of that valley, is flooded, that's the definition of a makas medina. So now let's bring it to our case, right? Well, not yet. Meaning, what's the gather of a makas medina? What we're saying now? Majority. That if this is something that affects the majority of people, now keep in mind, does not mean that the coronavirus affects the majority of people. The coronavirus affected everybody. But it means that the majority of people are therefore chased out of their homes, or put better, not allowed back into their homes. The majority of people, then we can call it a makas medina. So would we call this a makas medina? Would we say that the majority of people can't get back into their homes and are stuck outside of their homes and therefore don't have to pay? So to get a sense of how we even measure majority of what? Majority of who? Majority of Israelis? Certainly not. Majority of Israelis are in their homes. majority of young Israelis, majority of yeshiva Israelis, majority of Haredim, majority of Americans in Shana Rishona who are there and really miss mommy and daddy and therefore came home, majority of what? How exactly do you measure the majority? So there is a tshuva in Maran Padova, Simon Pei Vav, where he discusses a case where a melamed was hired to teach children, and then something happened in the neighborhood. Many of the residents had to flee, so the melamed didn't have anyone to teach, and he wanted to still get paid. So normally, a poel who can't do his job because of an ones doesn't get paid. He can't do his job, even though it's an ones. But if it's Makas Medina, then he does get paid. Then the balabais has to lose. So the Maran Padova is dealing with, is this a Makas Medina? The fact that there was some sort of virus going around, and all the children had to be, or many of the children fled the city because of it, is that called a Makas Medina? So Maran Padova says that since they didn't all run away from the city, it's not a Makas Medina. They only some people ran away, but not all of them. So the Ramah in Shin Lamed Daled Sif Aleph quotes this Maran Padova, and the Shach in Sif Katan Gimel is Medayek. Yeah, what did he say? Since they didn't all run away, it's not a Makas Medina. The implication is the Gedra of Makas Medina is all, not just Rove. So, whereas we started off by saying, we paskin, like Rabbi Yehuda in the Gemara, that a Makas Medina means rove of the fields have been ruined by that which is happening, Maran Padova says that if it's all, only if it's all, it's a Makas Medina. That's the kash of the Shach on Maran Padova. So even though the Ramah quotes this Maran Padova, the Shach has this major kasha that he seems to be against the Gemara. So how do we answer the Shach's kasha? Three possibilities. Comes along the Ktzais and Simon Shinchav Beis, and he distinguishes between an ones beguf hadavar, like the cases in Bab Metzia, where the field itself was ruined, or the yavul was destroyed, so in that case we follow the majority, versus an ones not in the guf hadavar, but an external ones, meaning nothing happened to the apartment. The apartment is fine. It's sitting there. The heat is working. The plumbing is working. Everything is fine. The apartment is good. It's just that you don't have access to get back into the country. Yes, it's an ones, but it's outside of the actual item that's in question. And in that case, you'd have to say kulo. Only if it applies to everybody is it a Makas Medina. So Rav Asher Weiss just points out, you know, in learning, this is a good thing to know. Sometimes in learning, you know, someone tries to make a tzushtal, they try to make a comparison between case A and case B. You say, no, those cases aren't the same, because this is like this and that. So you always have to think, not every time you can make a chilik does it make a difference. Meaning, if someone wants to... you split a cookie into two parts, right? So someone says, well, that part's not like that part because that one's bigger than that one. That makes a difference. But let's say you were to say, no, but that one's on the right side and that one's on the left side. You know, I split the cookie in two parts. I only want that one because that one's on the right side. I understand there is such a thing as right and left. And that one is on the right side and that one is on the left side. That does make sense. But why would that make a difference? It tastes the same wherever you cut it and put it down. So says Rav Asher Weiss, the ketos is making a chilek, but there's no nafkamina in this chilek. I mean, why would it matter whether the onus is beguf hadavar or the onus is external? It shouldn't make any difference. So says Rav Asher, we need a better answer to the shach's kasha. Should it be based on rov or should it be based on kulo? So Rav Asher suggests that when people run away, they're not always justified in doing so. Meaning, a lot of times people are just thrown into a frenzy and they're frightened for no good reason. Majority in that case would not be enough. It's not a good enough indicator that there's in fact an onus. You know when you have a good enough indicator? When it's kulo. But if you're talking about something that's objectively measured, the field can't produce anything now because it's been destroyed, the city has been burnt down, something like that, well then you know that it's a Makas Medina even with rov. It's not something that's tully in psychology and people's overreactions and how people deal with things. So then it's going to be tully in rov. That's how Rav Asher Weiss suggests. And he points out that there are sources that b'shas magefa, you should run away. The Magen Avraham in Tav Kofayin and Vav, Sivkat and Gimel, says in the name of the Shlach Kadosh that when they were avabuos porchos, I assume like the measles, they should get all the kids out of the city. And whoever doesn't go is mechayiv b'nafsho. So there are such a notion, but still, part of it is tully on human psychology. And then Rav Asher says, you know what the real answer is? The Maran Padua never really meant that they all have to run away. He was speaking b'derech kuzma. Majority is also good enough. He was dealing with a case where it wasn't even a majority. So he said, this isn't a makas medina by this melamed where the kids left down. Because how many kids left town? It wasn't a majority of the kids anyway. The way he expressed it is, you didn't have all of them running out of town. But he really meant you didn't even have a rove of them running out of town. Okay, great. So now that we know what a makas medina is, and that we're halachically going to say that if it affects rov, that makes it a makas medina, and that would mean that these couples would not have to pay their rent if it's a makas medina. So is this a rov? So it would seem that rov b'nei chutz laretz went back home. So can we consider it a makas medina? So young kolo families in these neighborhoods mostly did return home. Ramat Eshkol emptied out of the Shana Rishona, Shana Shnia type of, I have a niece and a nephew that lived in Ramat Eshkol this year and last year for the first 2 years of their marriage. They went and they got out of there, as did many others. So there are three arguments to make that that still doesn't make it a Makas Medina. First, there's room to argue, Mehechi Tesi, that you'd look at one subgroup of the population and measure rove based on, should you do it based on yeshiva? Like if the husband's learning in the mirror? Who says that you can measure rove based on that? So Rav Asher suggests that it seems that we can follow rove of these type of people because the Gemara spoke about rove hasados shebebika nishtadfu. It's a makas medina. That we measure by that neighborhood. We don't look at the whole city. We measure by whoever is right there. So apparently, even if the sados outside of this bika are unaffected, the majority, the way the Gemara said, the majority of the fields in this bika is what we look at. And the proof that you could look at a subset of the population is that the Maran Padua's case was a gzeiras hamoshel al Yisrael hamalvim beribis. Maran Padua is a case where they made a gzeira about Jews who are who lend with interest. And the entire meaning, and he has not the shaila about the melamed. He has a different shaila about a case where a guy rented a store because he's a money lender, and he makes his money by charging ribbis. So they made, and then after he signed the lease agreement, the government made new rules that any interest payments that are owed by Gentiles to Jews are canceled. That we're not going to enforce in our courts any and. Like 10 other non-Jewish moneylenders opened up shop then because it wasn't really a business for Jews to be in. So now this guy's got this shop that he signed a lease on and his whole business is killed. He can't do any business. So that in that case, the Maran Padua says it's a makas medina. Why? The shoemaker could still make a living. The tailor could still make a living, whatever Jews used to do. The shamish and the whatever, I don't know, the shochet, they could still make a living. Yeah, but moneylenders can't make a living. And rove money lenders is what we look at. So based on that, since we look at it, based on that Maran Padua, it seems that you do look at a subset of the population. Another argument to make that it's not a makas medina is that they all ran to places where the virus was much worse. I mean, look what happened in Eretz Yisrael. You know, the way Rav Asher writes it, he writes, like, say, he has such a golden pen. He writes, Bechemlas Hashem Aleinu, She'eretz Asher, Einei Hashem Elokeinu, Bamereshish Shana Adachrish Shana, Nifka Pachos Me'asher Rov Medinos HaOlam. Right? Borrowing from Pesukim Tanach, that the land that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always protects. And look what he did. He protected Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael, if you look at the numbers, the population in New York and the population in Eretz Yisrael and the comparison, how many people got sick, how many people died, it's unbelievable. So all these people were running away. Oh, the virus is a makas medina. So they're going right into the belly of the beast. They're going right into where the virus is worse. So you're going to call that a makas medina? So Rav Asher says, well, they were going home for Pesach anyway. The makas medina was not their going home. It was their inability to return that's a makas medina. So it's not the virus that's Makas Medina, it's the government shutting down the country that's a Makas Medina. And therefore he thinks it is a Makas Medina. My brother just pointed out that if they left before Purim, when nobody knew about the Magefa, that would be a good taina. But they left after Purim and they knew that the Magefa was spreading, and they moved up their flights because they knew their Magefa was spreading, and they left knowing that it wasn't going to be Pashut to get back in. Right? Meaning flights were being canceled, they were trying to fill up all the planes to get out of there, get all the yeshiva guys out of there, whatever. So they knew that it wasn't going to be pushed to get back in. So the onus isn't preventing them from returning. The desire to leave in the first place is preventing them from returning. That, you know, where they didn't have to leave in the first place. That was my brother's taina. Rav Asher never really stelled tzu to that taina. A third reason why you might argue that it's not a Makas Medina is maybe only when there's a loss of money, like fields flooding. There's a Makas Medina, but over here the tenant's not losing anything. He didn't lose any value. So it's most mistaver, though, Rav Asher says, that the inability to use your apartment, that's also called a hefsid. And the raya is that most poskim hold by a malamed, that when the poskim discussed whether that was a Makas Medina, no one said, oh, but there's no loss, so it can't be a Makas Medina. Even though there's no loss to the parents who are paying, it's still a Makas Medina. So then the question becomes, okay, now that we've established, if we buy it, if we accept this, that it is in fact a Makas Medina, do the tenants have the right to pay less or only to cancel the lease? So we're not going to have time to really go into this in great detail, but the Rama writes that, let's put it this way, there is a machlokas about this, also quoted in the Tshuva Maran Padova and Simon Lamites, the case where I told you before, where the money lender case. So there is a machlokas whether the guy who was renting the store can just pay less, because he didn't want to cancel the lease, he still wanted to stay in business, he just couldn't afford the old lease prices. So Maran Padova said that the money changer can cancel the lease with the argument that it's a Makas Medina, but he can't just pay less. And if he stays in the store and just wants to pay less, then he's accepting the original conditions of the rent. So now let's bring it back to our case. Like we said, these young couples, it is a Makas Medina, according to Rav Asher Weiss, and the tenants have the right to cancel their lease. But then they would need to get their stuff out of the apartments, just like when a lease ends, you got to get all your stuff out of the apartment. If they want to keep their stuff there, then they have to keep paying. So probably Rav Asher says they should compromise. But it's not clear how much of a compromise. You know, on the one hand, their stuff is still there. On the other hand, the landlord doesn't really have any other options either. Meaning, if they were to move all their stuff out, the landlord would, let's say, I'm going to call your bluff, right? You want to cancel the lease? I'm throwing all your stuff out of the apartment. Then how's the landlord going to make money? There's no one moving in. He's not going to find another young couple to take over the lease. He doesn't want to find another young couple. He's hoping this young couple comes back and he doesn't have to find a new tenant. So it's a complicated picture. So, you know, even though the maskir can say that, get all your stuff out of here, Rav Asher said, kofen al midas sedom. He wouldn't gain anything by doing that. And therefore, we would apply kofen al midas sedom over here. That's not pashut either, that we apply kofen al midas sedom. That seems to be machlokas rama and pischei tshuva. When we say kofen al midas sedom only a bidyeved? That if the person squatted in my property, kofen al midas sedom, I'm not allowed to charge him rent. But does that mean l'chadchila, I have to let him use my stuff? So that's a question. But Rav Asher suggests that we can't say that the landlord's getting hurt badly financially. I mean, someone would want to say, look, the landlord's getting killed over here. He's losing all of his money. He's not getting his rental payments. So we have to make this young couple. Their parents are rich parents in America that are paying, that are paying the bills. The kids don't have any money anyway. They don't pay anything anyway. The parents have plenty of money, probably. They're paying all the bills. So have rachmanis on the landlord. So Rav Asher Weiss absolutely rejects such an argument. You know that the parents are rich parents? Maybe the parents are just being moser nefesh so that the kids can start off marriage with a shana rishona, where they're learning properly, where they're living in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe, you have no idea. You know that the landlord doesn't have other investments in real estate. Maybe he owns a company that sells hand sanitizer or sells masks. You know, I was just walking down the street last week and a guy pulls over his car. You know, how you doing, Rabbi? Fine, how are you? He says, business is great. He's like, I sell, he sells like Lysol, not Lysol, whatever, you know, these disinfectants and masks and whatever. That's his business. He's like, it's unbelievable. I'm making a killing over here. And, you know, then he gave me a free thing of masks. Okay, so that was nice. So I have a free thing of masks. So how do I know? Maybe these parents have a business like that. I don't know. You can't know. Everyone's hurting badly. The economy's in shambles. So you can't say, oh, I have Rachmanis on this one. It's a Dine Maminis case. You have Rachmanis on that one. And then you're being extra machmir on the other one. So Rav Asher thinks la halacha they should come to some sort of compromise. And then he adds one final word. And he says, with all of these cases, the Batei Din and the Poskim should come to a uniform agreement. And this is so critical. You know, I'll tell you, I got so many calls a couple of weeks ago from people who have their kids registered in like a preschool or a play group or something like that. And they said, look, you know, the Mora tried to do a Zoom, you know, with 3-year-olds. Good luck. You know, it's not the same. The kid is bouncing off the walls. Do I owe the Mora money for the kids not going to school? So I said the same answer to all of them. I'm not going to answer your question. The way to answer your question is get all of the parents in the group to appoint a representative from the group and the Mora and have a Zoom meeting with the representative parents, the Mora, and a Rav, and figure out something that works. You got to get everybody on the same page. It has to be uniform, because what happens otherwise? This kid's parents ask Rabbi Leibowitz in North Woodmere, and he says X. And that one asks Rabbi Septimus in North Woodmere, and he says Y. And the other one asks Rabbi Witkin in North Woodmere, and he says Z. And, you know, three rabbis all within like a half a block of each other. But we each have a slightly different opinion. So that kid pays, you know, $1,000. That one pays $2,000. That one pays $3,000. That's ridiculous. Okay, they're all getting the same thing. So it has to be some sort of uniform psak that is agreed upon by everybody. And that's why Rav Asher writes, Lo tei adas Hashem, kitzon asher ein lehem roe. We shouldn't be like shepherdless sheep. The kol echad yaseh din liatzmo, and everyone deciding what they want to do for themselves. The Yishal Rav Shivsuk Biderich Hanochalo, and each one will ask their rabbi who hears their side of the story and doesn't want to disappoint their balabas. I cannot tell you how often this happens in Dine Maminis. And you know, most of you guys here have never dealt with Dine Maminis. Henry has, but most of you guys have never dealt with Dine Maminis. And I'll tell you, when you deal with Dine Maminis, never fall into that trap. If you're having a dispute with somebody else, don't go to your rabbi and say, Rabbi Paskin, and then say, oh, my rabbi Paskin, that I don't owe you any money and that you're a jerk. It's ridiculous. That's not the way it's meant to be. You go together with the other person, like a mensch, to a third party that you both respect, whether it be a Beis Din, whether it be just a Rav who has common sense and who has a little bit of knowledge of Chosh and Mishpat and who's basically a decent human being, and sit down and you work something out, and that's the way you handle it. You don't have one person ask a shayla without the other person there. Rav Asher writes, V'yischalil Shem Shamayim. That's a sure way to be mechalil Shem Shamayim. Upa'amim rabos tofa'azu evia anashim lifnos l'archos chalila. And he says, that's how people end up in secular court. Because that's the way they deal with their dine maminis. Okay, so that is it for tonight. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos, and thank you very much for coming to learn together this evening.
Thanks so much.